For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome. I want to speak this morning about the Bodhisattva precepts, the ethical guidelines in our tradition. Last Monday night, Hogetsu was here speaking about skillful means, but she's our sewing teacher who helps with teaching the sewing of robes or lay ordination robes like Kathy and Douglas are wearing at the end of their raksus or priest robes. Anyway, we have these formal ceremonies around these Bodhisattva precepts, and I'll say a little bit more about that later, but these are basically just for any of us, all of us who do Zazen, their expressions of Zazen and their guidance as to how to express this awareness that we uncover for ourselves in this sitting practice in our everyday activities. So they're not, some of them sound like the Ten Commandments a little bit. They're not thou shalt not. They're just kind of guidelines for us to remember about how to express Buddha mind in our life. So I'll read the 16 that we take formally, and each one of them I could give many Dharma talks about. So today is just a sort of overview, and I'll say a little bit about a few of them, or a couple of them, but there's first the three refuges. I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha. So this is Buddha means the awakened one, but it's also the principle of awakening. Dharma is the teaching of that and the reality of that and the teaching about reality, and Sangha is all of us, community. But in some ways all 16 come from I take refuge in Buddha, just that you're all here this morning because in some ways you're turning towards Buddha. And in our sitting practice, which we just did, we are sitting like Buddha. And through doing that, through doing these physical postures, these mudras, we learn aspects of the teaching. So just sitting upright like the Buddha in the center of the room, we learn this posture or attitude of uprightness. And in our bowing, we learn about respect and gratitude. All of the 16 come out of taking refuge in Buddha. But the first three are the three refuges. Then there's what we call the three pure precepts. I vow to embrace and sustain right conduct. Sometimes I translate it as I vow to avoid evil. I vow to embrace and sustain all good. And I vow to embrace and sustain all beings, which is very important for us because this is a practice that's very inclusive. Everybody in the world is part of what's happening in this room. That's something that, you know, is part of our teaching, that all the people who've ever influenced you, parents, of course, and teachers and so forth, are part of who you are sitting there. Gradually, we start to feel that viscerally. But it's subtle, anyway. But this is a practice of the Bodhisattva practices about universal liberation. We're not just sitting for ourselves, we're sitting for all beings in some real way. But that, of course, includes ourselves and all the ways in which we want to learn to be calm. As we sit, we learn about being calmer and settled and a little more open and having some more flexibility. Of course, not that that happens automatically. Those are all endless practices, as are these precepts. Next are the 10 grave precepts. And again, these are the ones that sound a little bit like the 10 Commandments, but they're not. They're just guidelines. Our translation, current translation of them, a disciple of Buddha does not kill. A disciple of Buddha does not take what is not given. A disciple of Buddha does not misuse sexuality. A disciple of Buddha does not lie. A disciple of Buddha does not intoxicate mind or body of self or others. A disciple of Buddha does not speak of faults of others. A disciple of Buddha does not praise self at the expense of others. A disciple of Buddha is not possessive of anything. A disciple of Buddha does not harbor ill will. A disciple of Buddha does not disparage the three treasures of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So that's the formal, our formal language for them now. And, you know, in more traditional Asian Buddhism, sometimes they've been translated more literally. So a disciple of Buddha does not intoxicate mind or body of self or others. In Asia, sometimes that's been, a disciple of Buddha does not sell alcohol. But, of course, we know that there are many things that can intoxicate us. So each of these is subtle. Each of these is a study. And when I work with people preparing for lay ordination, usually they take one or two and focus on them as a way of learning about all of them. So they're each one is really subtle. So just as the one about intoxication, a disciple of Buddha does not intoxicate mind or body of self or others. Just to see the ways in which each of us do have patterns of habits that can intoxicate us. So aside from alcohol or drugs, of course, and we do have a recovery group that meets here Tuesday night, but we can get caught up in, we can get be intoxicated with all kinds of things. Even with Zazen, people can get too attached to Zazen and forget about their everyday life. That's possible. It's more difficult practicing in the city. But how do we, so each of these has many aspects. It includes not just for ourselves, but if we're considering all being, disciple of Buddha does not kill means encourages others not to kill. And also each one of these has a positive side too. So to say disciple of Buddha does not intoxicate mind or body of self or others implies also the positive side of a disciple of Buddha does try to encourage for themselves and others a kind of clarity, a kind of awareness, instead of being caught up in patterns of habits that can happen in all kinds of ways. So, again, each one of these is a study, a subtle study, one that many people focus on. The disciple of Buddha does not harbor ill will. So some translations in Asia say the disciple of Buddha does not get angry. But that's really just, you know, not harboring ill will very, very quickly. We naturally have positive, negative, and neutral responses to whatever is going on around us. One commentary says that that you're violating that precept if you don't get angry when it's appropriate. So we have, you know, some people are tend more to anger. Some people tend more towards confusion. Some people tend more towards greed. But we all have all of these. So again, the precept just says the disciple of Buddha does not harbor ill will. So we don't hold on to our anger. If somebody says or does something that allows us to feel our anger, we feel it as our anger. And instead of holding on to that and making a harbor and turning that into grudge and resentment and hatred, we try to look at our own anger and see how to use that. It's tremendously energetic. A lot of energy in anger. We can turn that towards seeing clearly what's going on. We can turn that towards commitment or resolve to help in the situation that allowed us to feel our anger. So each of these is a very subtle lifetime study. This is adult education. How do we not get caught by our anger and not turn it into some, you know, I mean, the world is full of hatred and some kinds of people hate other kinds of people. Just, you know, it's kind of nuts. But how do we look at the natural, you know, we're electromagnetic beings, so we have positive and negative reactions. When we have some negative reaction, what do we do with that? How do we use that? So these are, again, not rules like never get angry. It's like they become most relevant when we realize that, oh, I'm harboring ill will. I like it that I don't like that person, and you know, I'm gonna do what I can to, you know, get back at that person, even, you know, and you know, war start from that. Again, this is just one of these 10, but just part of the study of it and the practice of it is not that we hear these precepts or formally receive them in a ceremony, but that we use them as reminders. And when we realize that we are, you know, starting to harbor ill will against someone, that's when the precept comes alive. So these are all, again, there are people who take these formally, but for all of us who sit zazen, these are natural expressions of zazen to use in our everyday activity. So I want to talk a little bit more about it and have some time for discussion as well. So maybe I'll say a little more about a couple of them. One of them that a lot of people have trouble with is, sometimes we used to have the translation, a disciple of Buddha does not slander. And now we say a disciple of Buddha does not speak of faults of others. And that's a pretty subtle one, and I've had to work with that, because sometimes you know, it's helpful to talk about a situation where somebody is doing, you know, acting like a jerk or doing some behavior that's unhelpful. So we can just, you know, to slander them would be to start calling them names or to start to harbor ill will or whatever. But how do we instead think about helping the situation? So a disciple of Buddha does not speak of faults of others. Doesn't mean to not speak about a situation, but not to talk about it in terms of blame or fault. Because we're all part of this circle of greed, hate, and delusion as human beings. How do you instead speak of a situation and you know, see the positive aspects of somebody, or see how you can help point something out? So all of these precepts require patience. A couple of Sundays from now, Nyozan is going to be talking about the practice of patience, another set of practices that we have. And it's difficult. It doesn't mean to just be passive and submit to whatever's going on, but we learn from sitting and being present and upright and waiting for the bell, or, you know, just being present, being there, how to be attentive. And that's practice of patience, means being willing or ready to respond when we see some way to respond that might be helpful. So somebody who's causing difficulty to you or to somebody else or to themselves, just jumping in and telling them what a blankety-blank they are isn't really going to be very helpful. How do you actually pay attention and look at what might be helpful? So one example from one of my students back in California, we have at least one lawyer in the room. This student of mine was a legal assistant, and she was working in a law firm, and there was a young woman lawyer who was just mean and nasty to everybody. And Rose just kind of didn't say anything, didn't do anything. She just really worked at being nice and speaking kindly to this person. And being patient. And one day this lawyer said to her, "Gee, I've been really mean, haven't I?" Something like that. I don't remember exactly. She got it. So rather than blaming or speaking a fault of others, how do we respond in a way that sees the positive possibility? that's one kind of dramatic example. So again, it's not that you have to go, you know, recite these to yourselves every day, although you could, and anybody who wants a copy of these, let me know. But just to have this awareness of these orientations as the traditional recommendation for how to express clear awareness in our everyday activities can be helpful. How do we, it says a disciple of Buddha does not kill. That's also very complicated. It means helping others not to kill. It means supporting life. So, again, each one of these is a study in itself. I thought I'd refer to, there are various commentaries on these, but one that I like is from Thich Nhat Hanh, the contemporary Vietnamese teacher. He has I think these may have changed since this version, but slightly, but he has 14 precepts of interbeing. He talks about interconnectedness in terms of interbeing, which is very nice. And so, just as a kind of way of elaborating on for not killing, he says, do not kill. Do not let others kill. Find whatever means possible to protect life and prevent war. So, we sit on various levels, working, studying, being present in this body mind on our cushion chair. We're also aware of the people around us, and they're part of, as you sit, thoughts arise. You probably noticed that. And we don't try and stop them. We don't try and do anything with them either. We just let them go, and they come again. But one level of our awareness as we're sitting is just, what's going on in this body and mind. So in some sense, we turn the light within. We're focusing on what's going on here on my seat this morning, apart from my ideas of who I am and what the world is. And that's a long-term practice, but we also then are aware of the people we've interacted with in the past week or days, or they're part of what's going on in our chair. Cushion. And in terms of these precepts, so we respond to people around us that way, but also these precepts are guidance for how to respond to all of the difficulties in our society that do impinge on us and affect us in lots of ways. So Thich Nhat Hanh says that the disciple of Buddha does not kill doesn't just mean that I don't kill things. And that can be interpreted in various ways. Some practitioners are vegetarians, but not all. But do not let others kill. Find whatever means possible to protect life and prevent war. So, that's the social application of it. Another one, this last precept, which is sort of related to not killing, but also related to not misusing sexuality. He says, do not mistreat your body. Learn to handle it with respect. Do not look on your body as only an instrument. So that's interesting because, most of what we do in ordinary everyday life is to use situations as instruments to try and, sometimes with very good intentions, to try and become better or try and help. But also sometimes in our culture we're taught to consume, to manipulate things, and ourselves sometimes to get what we want or get rid of what we don't want. So anyway, he says, do not look on your body as only an instrument. Preserve vital energies, sexual, breath, spirit, for the realization of the way. Sexual expression should not take place without love and commitment in sexual relations. Be aware of future suffering that may be caused. So to practice that with respect for yourself and any other. To preserve the happiness of others, respect the rights and commitments of others, be fully aware of the responsibility of bringing new lives into the world. Meditate on the world into which you are bringing new beings. So that relates a lot to not misusing sexuality, but it's also about not killing. How do we support the vitality and energy in our relationships, in ourselves, in others. So again, each one of these is, a huge, difficult lifetime practice. One of them that I'll mention from Thich Nhat Hanh again, a couple more. Part of our practice is, and this relates to embrace and sustain all beings, to benefit all beings. He says, do not avoid suffering or close your eyes before suffering. Do not lose awareness of the existence of suffering in the life of the world. Find ways to be with those who are suffering, including personal contact, visits, images, and sounds. By such means, awaken yourself and others to the reality of suffering in the world. So this relates to actually, many of these ten, but our practice is not to turn away. This relates to intoxication. Part of intoxication is when we find something to distract ourselves. And sometimes this world is difficult. Our own problems or the problems around us, in traditional Buddhism, this is called the Saha world, the world of endurance. So it's a good place to learn patience. So our practice includes not avoiding difficulties or suffering. Sometimes we need to, take a break or have some rest and relaxation or recreation, and that's okay. One doesn't have to wallow in suffering, but to not close our eyes before suffering. So we've been talking about that in recent weeks, some about grief and how do we face sadness and how do we help others to face sadness. And that means sometimes including recognizing the processes of grieving, including denial or anger or whatever. But how do we, be willing to be present in all of our life? Of course, sometimes in the middle of practice we feel joy, and it's important to not avoid gratitude and joy also. So he says, do not lose awareness of the existence of suffering in the life of the world. Find ways to be with those who are suffering. So that's this bodhisattva work, that we include all beings. Another of Thich Nhat Hanh's elaborations of these precepts has to do with what's sometimes called right view. This applies to a number of these ten, but in Buddhism there's this idea of the Eightfold Path, which includes things like right livelihood and right action and right speech and right mindfulness. But also right view, and this I think is difficult for us and very important. I think this relates to not killing and also not lying. So he talks about being open to hearing others. So he says, do not be idolatrous about or bound to any doctrine, theory, or ideology, even Buddhist ones. Buddhist systems of thoughts are guiding means. They are not absolute truth. So that applies very much to these precepts themselves, that there's not, we can interpret them in some ways very strictly, and that's appropriate in a lot of contexts, just not to kill, not to take what's not given. But each of them has this kind of subtler aspect, and whatever our idea about them is, and whatever our idea, and this is the problem with a lot of religion, where they have some doctrine or dogma and think they have to impose that on everyone. So you can be here and not be a Buddhist. I don't care if you're a Buddhist. It's not the point. Even though, my job is to make available Buddhist teaching for those who are interested, but you can come and just sit. And, we have people in our Sangha who are Christian clergy, and so they are, you don't have to believe any particular Buddhist teaching. you might, you know, see if you can learn from it. But anyway, he also says, do not, his second one, that was the first about not being idolatrous, do not think the knowledge you presently possess is changeless, absolute truth. Avoid being narrow-minded and bound to present views. Learn and practice non-attachment from views in order to be open to receive others' viewpoints. Truth is found in life and not merely in conceptual knowledge. Be ready to learn throughout your entire life, to observe reality in yourself and in the world at all times. So if we think we know, then we aren't open to learning anything more. So Tsuki Roshi, my teacher's teacher, wrote this book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. So we talk about beginner's mind as something that, no matter how long we've been doing this practice, to be open to learning something new. Or sometimes this is talked about in terms of not knowing, or seeing various ways of knowing. And it doesn't mean to, if you see something, that he has something else about not lying, including speaking truth to power, as it were. So sometimes we have to say our viewpoint, but then we also have to be open to hearing other viewpoints. So all of these are really subtle, and again, each one of these is a topic for lots of practice. The point is just how do we settle into being present and upright in this meditation practice, and then gradually over time see how that expresses itself in our uprightness in the world, with friends, with family, with coworkers. How do we, in our relationships with parents or children, how do we express this gentle, upright mind, which has this physical side too? How do we, to study, for example, not killing or not lying, means to look and see how it feels when we're not sure if we're kind of on the edge there. So I do want to have time for questions and discussion, but just to say a little bit about this ceremony we do, so that you know that that's available. We have a lay ordination ceremony where Kathy and Douglas are wearing these roksus, these robes. Douglas, can you hold out so people can see it? Yeah, so these are things they sewed themselves, and they're smaller models of the priest robes that Eishin and Myozan are wearing. I'm wearing actually a store-bought one, but I have numbers of them that I sewed myself. They sometimes need mending. So, there's a particular practice of sewing a robe for people who are interested in lay ordination. And if you've been around, if you've been sitting here for a little while, practicing here for a little while, you can ask me about this. But it also involves studying these 16 precepts, studying one or two in particular, and in some ways all of them. And it also, the ceremony involves receiving a lineage chart that goes back to Shakyamuni Buddha and goes down to the various teachers, Bodhidharma, who brought it from India to China, and Dogen, who brought it to Japan, and Suzuki Roshi, who brought this lineage to America, and also receiving a Dharma name. So that's a ceremony that is available here for people practicing well. You can ask me about it if you're interested. But again, it's not necessary to do that. In some sense, that involves taking refuge in Buddha in some ways. If you think of it as openly stating that you are committed to Buddha or whatever that means. But again, you don't have. It's not that people who do that are better practitioners necessarily. Just to sit in zazen these ways of seeing how to be responsive and helpful in the world are part of our practice, are there. So, maybe I'll mention also, if you are interested in talking with me individually, with a teacher, it's called Doug-san, is our Japanese word for it. You can email info@ancientdragon.org, and I'm available sometimes before or after the Zazen and talk Sunday morning, or other times during the week too. And also, if you would like to have practice discussion with Nyozan or Aishin, they're available for just talking about practice. So email info@ancientdragon.org to arrange an interview, or you can just speak to them. So, again, this is something we talk about sometimes, but not always and not enough, and we're going into our practice commitment period where we're going to be talking about all these subtle Zen koans, but I wanted to kind of say something about this as kind of background for all our practice tomorrow evening. For those of you who come to both, I'll be talking about a different group of practices, the 6 or 10 transcendent practices or paramitas, which are also, again, guidance for how to express our wholehearted uprightness in the world. We could see these as ethical practices or beneficial practices. So maybe that's enough for me to say. It's just a very broad overview of how this sitting practice relates to our whole lives. So comments, questions, responses, please feel free. Or if you have questions about any of those 10 that I mentioned, or 16. Kathy, what's your favorite precept?
The one about not lying. Because there's something in it about how you represent yourself, like being honest, not trying to be something you're not. That speaks to me.
Good, yeah. That's a good way of expressing some of the depth of that one. And yet, I'm speaking about these partly inspired by Hogetsu, our sewing teacher, last Monday night, talking about she was talking about the women ancestors and one of our very recent women ancestors, Darlene Cohen, who is a friend of mine at San Francisco Zen Center, now passed away, but she, as she was dying, she said, "I don't believe in karma and all that crap, but somebody asked her, this is just as, she was days from dying, one of her students asked, "Well, what do you believe in?" She said, "I believe in skillful means. I'm willing to lie to anybody." So that's the other side of that, that she was concerned with benefiting and helping her students in whatever way was necessary. That's a very controversial teaching, the skillful means that she was talking about. But I don't think it contradicts what you were saying about, so Darlene was very forthright and she was very much herself. So in a way she wasn't lying, but she would say anything that was helpful. Aishin.
Well, along those lines, I was thinking of this as it relates to lying or speaking of faults of others or, killing or any of them really. Somebody pointed out to me in a group where we were discussing the precepts that maybe the underlying idea behind the precepts, behind each of the precepts, is to not create duality. And if we think about, we can hold the precepts very rigidly and like, I'm not going to lie, and then we wind up saying things that, maybe are harmful because we haven't figured out how to graciously, say something that is palatable, that isn't the 100% truth as we see it. But so I think about, in practicing each of the precepts, Am I creating a situation, am I seeing this as a situation that's outside of me that I want to turn away from or manipulate or, mm-hmm. you know, change my relationship to, or am I seeing it as a situation that I'm interdependent with? So, you know, for anger, I can accept that I might be angry in a situation, but I'm continuing to try to work with myself and with the situation to not try to sort of turn away from it.
Yeah.
Or get my own gain out of it. Just trying, or speaking of the faults of others, we can speak of the faults of others in a neutral way that allows us to still be connected and trying to help something.
Yeah, but then maybe we're not speaking of them as faults, we're speaking of them as
facts, or
as actions that that have consequences that we don't like.
Right, right.
I mean, it's subtle. Yeah. Each of these is very, very subtle, and that's part of the point.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
They're more than just faults. They're faults maybe in our eyes, but...
Or they may be a really harmful action, you know.
Yeah.
Increasing climate damage or something. I don't know. You know, there are harmful actions in the world. But how do we talk about it in a way that's not just blaming and vindictive, and, you know, how do we talk about it in a way that has some possibility of illuminating and helping?
Sure. Well, lots of actions are intended to have benefit, but they also have some negative effects. You know, how do we keep looking at that and maybe try to work towards something that still has benefit, but maybe it doesn't have the unintended negative effects.
Yeah, good. So that's exactly what these precepts are about, is that it's not about being perfect or pure. Trying to be perfect is a huge obstacle in practice. We're human beings. This is a practice for human beings. How do we engage our life without, this is what Thich Nhat Hanh was getting at in terms of being idolatrous, you know. We don't have some idea about what it means to not kill, that then we might lay on somebody else who's, you know, like being self-righteous about being a vegetarian and attacking people who are not, for example. Not that it's not good to be a vegetarian. I mean, it is, vegetarianism is good, but how do we not hold on to something? So what you were saying about that, you know, duality. This is the subtlety of these practices, and my favorite Zen koan of all time is from a great American yogi who said, "If the will were perfect, it wouldn't be." So, how do we see another way of talking about this? You were talking about duality and getting caught in duality, and me and you, and all that. Separation. Another way to see this is from the Lotus Sutra. It says the point of all, the reason for all, the single reason for all Buddhas appearing in the world is simply to help suffering beings onto the path towards awakening. So these are all intended to help ourselves and others to wake up, to be more kind. And so each one of these is very subtle. And yet, they can serve as real tools and help for us when we're not sure about where we're at. Other comments or questions? Specific questions? Dan.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your talk. And anger was kind of going through my head. And for me, what's difficult is... right now, at this moment, I mean, and it's serious for me because it affects me in a lot of ways, and it's politicians make me angry, and I had to stop watching news. You know, and...
Me too, at least some news, yeah.
Yeah. And I become a politician of news now. I think it's a lie, you know. But, you know, I was thinking about anger, and you know, it can be put to use so well. I was thinking of Selma Marches. You know, if it wasn't for anger, Selma Marches never would have happened, you know?
Right, right, right. So what's that old bumper sticker, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention?
Yeah.
There is that commentary that it's that you're breaking the precept if anger doesn't arise when it's appropriate. So yeah, in that situation though, harboring ill will is if you, you know, turn some resentment towards some particular politician into a hatred, that doesn't help. But how do you, when some upset arises about some idiotic action that's being promoted by the Congress or the Supreme Court or whomever, you know, how do you turn that energy of anger towards speaking truth about that and trying to encourage others to speak truth about it and maybe writing letters or, you know, or voting? Or I was going to announce in the announcement part that we have an election coming up on April 7th, a very important national election, even though it's a local election for mayor and aldermen, so I hope people will register if you're not and vote April 7th. But, you know, to turn what we feel unhappy about towards, well, how do I respond constructively? That would be an example of, you know, in that situation, there may be many other ways to respond. So yeah, anger is can be helpful, but then what do we do with it? Time for one or two more questions or comments. David?
No, one thing you just mentioned got to me a little bit, because when I thought of the civil rights movement and when I and how I participated in it, it wasn't so much in anger. It was going towards a place of a greater good. A greater good.
Okay.
You know, that it's, I don't think that the people crossing the bridge were not angry. They were marching for something. And it was a belief that people were equal and that was not so much an anger, but a disappointment that wasn't taking place. And it allowed them to march in a way that was respectful and not fight back. And the anger was in the state police.
Yeah.
For trying to keep something repressed. And the question is, you know, I when I first came to Buddhism, I read a book, and what I liked about the book is that he said, not that you do not kill, but you refrain from harming others.
Yeah.
And it was more of a way of being rather than a this commandment, you should do this. You know, it was more of by practicing the way we become this rather than fighting something in that sense. And I'm wondering when you say, because there's so many different translations for that precept, you know, thou shalt do no harm, thou shalt refrain from harming others, you know.
Let's actually, yeah. I'm sorry.
So there's so many different translations or wordings of that. And for me personally, the one of restraint and looking for the good rather than angrily responding.
Yes, thank you. But actually that's somewhat different teaching. This precept is not to kill, not to take life. Underlying it very much is the very, very early basic Buddhist principle of ahimsa, not harming. So this not killing is kind of an elaboration of that, but in some ways all of these are about not harming. So, you know, maybe you could boil Buddhist ethics down to not harming and benefiting all beings. But I wanted to say something about anger in connection with that. So if anyone has not seen the movie Selma, it's very moving and I recommend it. So I don't know about all of them. On some level, there was anger that led to the determination that Dr. King and many, many others had to just step forward and to respond and to not submit to segregation and so forth. So I remember Aitken Roshi saying once that Gandhi was a very angry guy. So it's not that we should... It's not that... If there's anger, there's anger, but then how do we turn it? And the Selma March is a really good example of, as you said, in a very dignified, peaceful, respectful way, and, which includes just walking, and in the movie Gandhi you see this too, walking into physical harm to stand up for their principles. But somewhere originally, maybe for some of those people, there was anger and it got turned towards what you're talking about seeing how to act towards in a positive way. And this is, you know, and just to say that we have our personal karma of anger and our social karma of anger is so complex. Racism is so deep in this country in terms of wiping out Native Americans, in terms of slavery and still racism and all the things that are happening with young black men being unarmed men being shot by police and you know, it's so deep in all of us. So just to study that is also the precept of not killing, of not harming, to see how it affects everything in the society. So it's very much part of, you know, the just the world we live in. So acknowledging that, acknowledging the anger that, you know, was part of the original motivation towards non-harming and benefiting beings. This is part of the complexity of all this. So thank you for bringing that up. Time for one last... yes, Kathy.
Just in response to that, it's, you know, it's like anger is one of those things that, you know, I've dealt with work with, I think we all have over the years. But it seems that you learn something, that if you're angry, if you're feeling it, it's important to kind of sink into it and understand what you're angry about, because I think deciding what to do, sometimes there is a need for assertiveness over something you're angry about. Sometimes there's a need to understand it from the duality, but I think sometimes a decision about action comes out of anger, but it's also important to not keep just sitting in an angry stew. You know, like
right.
the political stuff, like I, you know, that's a lot of that used to make me angry. I mean, still does, but not as much. But I find that I've gone toward listservs in terms of signing petitions. The way they word it, it's like there's a need now for voices to support this. That is much easier for me to deal with than the kind of lots of, I don't know, stirring comments about how this horrible thing is happening. And, you know, it's a... And so, you know, that's just an example for me of finding people who can represent it in a way of what needs to be done that you can do something about that conveys it to you. That anger got kind of shifted into something that I can do assertively that deals with it.
Yes, good. Yeah, so how do we respond constructively and positively without being, you know, anger is, it injures us. When we are angry at somebody, at somebody else, you know, yogically we can feel it in our throats or, you know, maybe our shoulders or somewhere that, and so to study our own anger, to own our own anger, and then that helps us turn it towards, well, how can I respond in a, not, in a way that is helpful to all beings, to everyone involved. So anyway, there's endless discussions about all of these, but I wanted to bring it up just as a kind of background overview for our practice and how it gets reflected in our everyday activity.